Welcome to this podcast. I'm here with Herbert London, President Emeritus of the Hudson Institute and a fellow at the Institute here in New York, and with Ann Neal, who's with us by telephone, who is the head of ACTA, the American Council of Trustees and Alumni. I expect you want to talk about the role of the trustees here and elsewhere, Ann, but let me start with Herb. Herb, talk to me about what you think the major mistake was at Penn State.
Well, the major mistake was overlooking a terrible tragedy. Obviously, there were young people who were being victimized, and people did not want to say anything about it in order to protect the football program. I understand that. And when you talk about Penn State and people say, we are Penn State, what they're talking about is Penn State football, the Lions of Penn State. And there's a great tradition there, and I understand and appreciate it. I also appreciate many of the things that Joe Paterna did in the past. After all, there were many people, many youngsters who came to Penn State without any understanding of language or communications or how to even do basic mathematics. And Joe and his wife would tutor many of the students who were at Penn State at the time. He gave $4 million to the library. He did very many positive things. And it's unfortunate and a tragedy that all we can say about Joe Paterno is that he averted his gaze when this terrible tragedy was occurring.
Right. And what's your view of Penn State?
Well, I think we've got to look at it as really the paradigm for a broader governance problem that we see throughout higher education. I think that trustees for many, many years have really viewed their role as more that of booster. And I think the way the system operates, it's not surprising that they basically come to the football games, go out to the nice dinners, and then go home, having not really exercised their fiduciary responsibility. So I think, if anything, while it's a terrible tragedy and something that we all regret, it nevertheless does help emphasize that these are not just special roles for honor, but in fact are legal fiduciary responsibilities, and that these trustees are going to have to be held to account at Penn State and everywhere else to balance athletics and academics and to really put the academic mission first and foremost.
And it seems to me that this period we're in now, the last few months, has been the most rich in faulty trustees. The University of Virginia, where they bent one way and fired the president and bent the other way and hired the president back, all in a 10-day period. How do you assess that?
Well, I take a different turn on it. Obviously, the process at the University of Virginia of firing and then rehiring the president was very poor. No transparency whatsoever. It was not the way to do it. But I do think the Board of Trustees was rightly looking at the issues of quality and cost that boards need to be looking at everywhere. And I think if we compare UVA and Penn State, we will see how hard it is for trustees and why it's important for parents and the public and the media to get behind them when they're trying to make changes. Because if you think about UVA, you've got the board, they're asking legitimate questions about quality and cost, and the amount of pushback that was received from those who benefit by the status quo was incredible. The trustees got no real break for actually doing their job and asking questions. You look at Penn State, which is the traditional model, where the trustees were asking no questions and were sitting there like potted plants. Did anybody raise any concern? Did anybody say they weren't doing their job? No. In fact, this was, largely accepted. So I think it does show that the culture does not reward or benefit or in any way help trustees who do want to do their job, and that's the culture we've got to change.
Right. One of the things that you have to look at, Ann, is the superordination of football in the college ranks. So often the football program is the program. It represents the university. It generates a lot of income, and people overlook the fact that we're these so-called student-athletes are students in addition to being athletes, and we overlook that problem. We've overlooked it at Penn State, where, in fact, the football program became the way to define what Penn State was all about. And I think this is a tragedy in itself and also something that the Board of Trustees overlooked.
Herb, let me ask you.
Oh, absolutely. No, sorry.
Excuse me.
Sorry, John.
I just wanted to point out that Harvey Silverglade, the great civil liberties lawyer and co-founder of FIRE, had a piece for Minding the Campus, the site I edit for the Manhattan Institute. And he argued that every tragedy on campus is followed by calls for more regulations, more bureaucracy, more lawyers and experts in avoiding moral responsibility. Comment on that, Herb.
Well, one of the problems, of course, is that these controls add costs dramatically, and these mandates very often do not make sense. It seems to me that the private university, going back to Marbury versus Madison, should be a private institution operating entirely on their own without the interference of government. But since all people, all of the universities today, feed at the public trough in one way or another, the government feels it's appropriate for the government activities to insinuate themselves into the way in which the university conducts its affairs. I think it is really quite inappropriate. And not only does it add costs, it adds to the extraordinary bureaucracy, the growth of bureaucracies within universities. It just doesn't make much sense to me.
Right. The other story that's in the news, or has been in the last few months, the trustees at Dartmouth, who have been accused of feathering their own nests by letting out contracts that enrich themselves personally without any responsibility to the university or the alumni. Have you followed that case? And if so, what do you think of it and what would you recommend?
Well, again, I have not followed it closely, but I think it's not unique to Dartmouth. I think we see this at a lot of particularly the nonprofit, top-rated, if you will, liberal arts colleges, where you have folks who are coming from Goldman Sachs and other places and who then enter into various arrangements. I think it's a problem of conflict, not only at that board, but at other places. There should be immense transparency in terms of where people are coming from, what their particular business connections are, and it should be very clear before any kind of arrangement of a financial nature is entered into that the rest of the board is aware of those connections, that anyone who is involved recuses him or herself, and that these kinds of things not be done just behind the closed doors without any particular vigilance or oversight.
Right. One of the things that you have to consider is that so many members of boards of trustees are there to sanitize their own reputations. They're given this understanding that now they have legitimacy as a member of a board. They do not know, and very often do not know, how universities operate. They are unwilling to play a significant role in challenging the president when it's appropriate to do so. And so boards of trustees, by and large, become a rubber stamp. That, I think, is another issue that has to be examined carefully.
Well, and I think clearly that's the whole purpose behind the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, because there is, in fact, this historic culture of rubber stamping. And I think we're now finding higher education at an immense time of challenge with the economic downturn, with fewer resources from the state. There's never been a more important time for trustees to engage their jobs thoughtfully and intelligently. Now, you raised that issue about deference to presidents, and I think that's another very interesting question here. And it was put first and foremost by the Penn State matter. As we saw, the NCAA came down hard on Penn State and entered into a consent decree. But we believe strongly that one of the problems for trustees is that the existing culture marginalizes them. If you noted the press release and the press conference from the NCAA, they made it very clear that going forward, presidents and chancellors were in charge. And that's part of the problem. When we look at Penn State, Graham Spanier was in charge, and the board deferred to him way, way too much. And I think if you look at the NCAA rules, if you look at the rules that the Association of Governing Boards has put out there for trustee oversight, they essentially give lip service to trustees, but in fact want them to be deferential to presidents. And until they start to provide a competing look at the competing perspectives and service checks and balances, they will continue to be rubber stamps, as Herb says.
Let me ask Herb a question. Herb, you know a lot about sports. What do you think of revoking past bowl victories or past wins in the college leagues? How can you revoke a past?
Well, obviously you can't. I mean, what the NCAA is doing, in my judgment, is penalizing the innocent and letting the guilty go free. I mean, what you have here is Sandusky is going to spend the rest of his life in prison. But who is responsible for the incidents that occurred at Penn State? It's the president of the university. It's Joe Paterno, who has passed this mortal coil. It's a number of assistant coaches who obviously averted their gaze because they didn't want to damage the football program. a $60 million fine and revoking the past, which is what the NCAA has proposed, makes very little sense to me.
Could this have happened at another university? I mean, Penn State's a decent college, but it often looks like a football team with a college lightly attached. Could this have happened anywhere else?
Well, it did happen at USC, where, in fact, USC revoked the past, largely because of the overtures that were made to Reggie Bush before he entered the pro ranks. So, I mean, it did happen, and, of course, what they did is also penalize USC in the future by suggesting they could not engage in bowl performances. So I think that it could happen. But, again, what's happening in this case is that Penn State has now become the model for the nation.
Right. And let me ask you about the role of alumni, since that's your concern, too. Have alumni come forward in any of these recent scandals to press the issue?
I think alumni have been on both sides, quite frankly, particularly at Penn State. Some were appalled. Some really felt that Joe Paterno was the be-all and end-all. I think the problem here is that many alums feel that these football teams are the way that their university gets preeminence. It's the way they bring in money. And as I think we've seen in various studies, there are only a handful of schools that actually have money-making football programs. So I think alums have been led down the primrose path to believe that this is financial gold for their institutions, when for most of them, and it's not. And I think if they were aware of that and were properly pointed to the fact that these are academic institutions, not football games, that I think that they could be a helpful force for reform.
And what I think you may be overlooking is that it's very intoxicating on a Saturday morning to wake up in Notre Dame and to think that you're going to the football game, and there is Notre Dame playing Michigan. There are 100,000 people in the stands, all cheering for your team. It's very easy to be inebriated on what you're seeing. And for an alumni member to at that point say, well, you know, I'm far more concerned about the academic program. The academic program is a distant memory. Most of them don't even think about it. And the fact that you have something called a student athlete is itself an oxymoron.
And that's where these the boards and the presidents have to do a much better job of focusing on the appropriate balance between academics and athletics.
And let me ask you, and then Herb, because we're running out of time, what specific reform does the Penn State scandal seem to suggest to you? What should colleges do that they're not doing now?
Well, for one, they need to change the structure of that board. It's far too large. It's very typical. A lot of these university boards, which are more fundraising boards than they are governing bodies, and ACTA has gone on record as recommending that that board be downsized to no more than 13 or 14 in order to be an actual workable board. And I think also one of the things we've learned is that they need to hire their own staff. They need to have their own general counsel, their own board secretary who reports to the board and provides independent resources. Oh. I think too often we forget that the general counsel is employed by the president, that the NCAA rules are focused on the president. And so therefore, again, they emasculate the governing board in ways that produce the tragedies we've been seeing. A real lesson here is that rubber stamping is just not acceptable, that boards are going to have to set the agenda and they're going to have to demand reporting from the administrators who report to them.
Well, Anne, who is one of the great voices in higher education, I think has stated it very well. My own feeling is that we have to look at governance in higher education in very general terms. What do we mean by a board of trustees? What authority does it have? What is the role of the president? And how does it relate to the board? These are questions that I think have to be addressed and redressed. And in my opinion, it is going to be one of the great questions that emerges in higher education over the next 10 years.
I want to thank our guests, Herbert London and Anne Neal. It's been an excellent discussion of the folly at Penn State. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.